Welcome to Oncology Today, clinical update on the current management of advanced urothelial bladder cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Petros Grievas from the University of Washington Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle. To begin, Dr. Grievas commented on the importance of collaboration between urologists and medical oncologists in the management of patients with urothelial bladder cancer, particularly those with non-muscle invasive disease.
This is a very important question, Neil, because we see an increasing, I would say, involvement of medical oncologists in the management of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that we did not see in the past, mainly, as you pointed out, because of the introduction of immune checkpoint inhibitors like pembrolizumab that has FDA approval in BCG-unresponsive carcinoma in situ, plus minus papillary disease, and also the many ongoing clinical trials that evaluate the role of checkpoint inhibition in NMIBC, non-muscle invasive disease. And this, I think, is more evident in the context of academic centers like ours when you have the opportunity to work together with urology. And there are two examples of that, how we do it in our practice. One of them is we have a multidisciplinary bladder cancer clinic where we have medical oncology, radiation oncology, and urologic oncology, as well as pathology and radiology. They're sitting together in the same room. So in brief, 8 a.m., there are four new patients every Tuesday morning. We have a clinic coordinator who works with the intake team. The pace, we get all the records, you know, we try to get updated labs and imaging studies. Patient comes in at 8 a.m., usually a trainee or an advanced practice provider see the patient, four of them, and then 9 to 10, we have a tumor board. We discuss the case about a quarter of, for each patient, total of 1 hour for patients, and then we review the scans, we review the pathology, and then we go back to the room. The patient stays in the same room, and the faculty rotates, goes from room to room, so they see all the specialties, one-stop shop in half a day. So they leave around noon, and we have usually a plan. We have, focus on a particular plan. Sometimes these patients may be candidate for radical cystectomy or bladder preservation. We preserve it in a balanced way, and there is a great alignment, in the message out there. Even if it's more than one option, we give them a balanced approach. Patients love it. It's, the satisfaction scores are extremely high. The feedback we get is high. And also we have high accruals in clinical trials. Even outside the context of this clinic, we have significant advantage of the collocation. When it comes to non-muscle invasive disease, I can share with you that pembrolizumab was approved a while ago. The anecdotal uptake in clinical practice is not as high as we had expected, mainly because there have been some other intravesical options. For example, intravesical chemotherapy. We have seen retrospective data with gemcitabine docetaxel intravesically with high clinical response rates. And the patients are kind of accustomed to the idea of intravesical therapy because of prior BCG. And also we have other clinical trials that we're doing in that space. And of course, occasionally, every now and then, you may have a patient with active autoimmune disease, may not be a great candidate for intravenous checkpoint inhibition. So for all the above reasons, the uptake has not been as high, but definitely intravenous pembro is an FDA-approved option and should be considered case by case. The question is, what will happen now that we have recent approvals of nadofaragene and firadenovec, December 2022, if manufacturing catches up and the drug becomes available more widely, is given once every 3 months, and that's attractive to patients with less visits. And then the recent approval of the interleukin-15 superagonist, the NH03, that's also going to become available soon. So because intravesical options become more, I would say, abundant, it was unprecedented for BCG-responsive disease, I think that probably is going to get, set of the kind of first line and maybe something, maybe use second line. So the future might be, less use of intravenous pembro, maybe later on. And obviously radical cystectomy is an important option for many of those patients. So it's a dialogue with the patient about when to do radical cystectomy. And some patients, they want to keep declining, but it of course requires a good education to them and then dialogue.
So as we're This is really a follow-up to the AUA meeting, and our primary target audience today is the urologist, although we hope other people will use this program as well. And another issue that relates to sort of this interface between the urologist and medical oncologist is metastatic disease. And, you know, I've kind of had the thought that, you know, once the primary local therapy is done, the patient gets out into the metastatic setting, you know, that's pretty much the oncologist's territory. But I've had it pointed out to me by a number of urologists that even people with metastatic disease and bladder cancer, maybe as opposed to, for example, breast cancer, where they come in, they get their surgery, and when by the time they get mets, they haven't seen, you know, they're seeing the surgeon once a year. And the urologists are saying, no, we keep seeing these patients because they have obstruction, they have stents, they developed a strong connection to us because they've gone through a cystectomy and they want to know our opinion, et cetera. And I hadn't really thought about it. But do you see that actually? I mean, your situation may be different because you've got them right there, but, you know, out in the community. Is that true? Do you think urologists are part of the patient's care until they die?
I think you're right, Neil. I think we see more and more use of urology, even in metastatic disease. To your point, because patients have, you know, potentially ongoing needs, especially if the primary tumor is in place. And if we envision a future where we may have less cystectomies and more bladder preservation, that's where the direction we try to go as a community, listening to the patient voice and advocacy groups, that may make this point even stronger. Issues that urologists can help us with, you mentioned obstruction. Sometimes, you know, patients may need a nephrostomy tube or a stent, depending on the case and patient preference in metastatic disease. And then you may have issues with local symptoms, you know, that may be caused by the tumor if the primary is in place. Even if the primary is not in place, even if the patient has cystectomy and they have an ostomy, that may, you know, sometimes raise questions about the optimal ostomy management long-term, or if they have a neobladder, you know, rarely they may have, you know, some needs or questions there. The other angle of it, Neil, is that, you know, as we get better and better with systemic therapies, we talked about the data with pembrolizumab and enfortumab that were presented at ESMO and ASCO GU. There is a question being generated, especially in locally advanced disease or node positive disease, and potentially as a concept, it's an open question about oligometastatic disease in the future. Is there a role or not with consolidative local regional definitive therapy in the context of radical cystectomy, lymph node dissection, or chemoradiation, for example, in extreme responders? If you have an N3 disease, right, and, you know, common iliac lymph nodes there that are, you know, enlarged, and, you know, you're worried about, of course, systemic disease in those patients, micrometastasis. Let's say this patient gets PEMBRO-EV, they get a CR, and they want to be aggressive, they're young and fit. What do you do in those patients? So that's a great example of the multidisciplinary bladder cancer clinic we have with Tumor Board. We look at the patient, characteristics of the patients, functionality, performance status, medical comorbidities, imaging, and then we may decide to potentially consolidate. And that's, I think, a need for a clinical trial in that domain to try to, number one, evaluate, is there a role, yes or no, for consolidative approaches, either with surgery or radiation. And number two, can we potentially de-escalate, you know, EV pembro in terms of duration of therapy long-term because of toxicities that can be associated with the long-term of use of those systemic therapies?
So you mentioned oligomets, and I'm curious, what are the scenarios where you think about local therapy in general with people with oligometastatic disease, how generally you define it, and where you usually see it?
It's a great question. You know, we have seen various definitions of oligometastatic disease, especially in other tumor types. To be honest with you, Neil, we have not, at least in my practice, we have not used that much consolidation therapy in the context of M1 disease because I'm very worried about other micromets that may be present somewhere else. The imaging, of course, in bladder cancer is good. We have CTs, we have MRIs. On occasion, case by case, we may use a PET scan, but the imaging is not perfect. And because of natural history of the disease, usually I'm worried about what I may not be able to see on conventional scans. For that reason, I would say the definition and and the consolidation of oligometastatic disease has been very rare in the context of M1 disease. Usually we go with systemic therapy. We used to have GemCis or GemCarbo followed by Avelumab maintenance. Now we have GemCis Nivo or EV Pembro, and usually these patients get a maintenance IO in either of those regimens. And then the scenario, you know, comes again case by case, especially the node positive disease in the pelvis, disease confined in the pelvis, and not outside the pelvis. I think these are the gray zone scenarios where consolidation may have a role even more, and especially in the context of a great complete response. And again, this is a case-by-case discussion with urologists or radiation oncologists. We discuss these patients more and more these days because of the effectiveness, the response rate, the quality of response, the depth of response, and the durability of response, you know, with some regimens like Pembro EV. These questions become more and more common, especially in the pelvic-confined advanced disease. And then maybe occasionally in a borderline M3 to M1 scenario that these lymph nodes are in the border of the pelvis, this question may become, again, a great tumor border clinic discussion. For more distant disease, I think we need trials. And I'm open to those trial designs as we get better with effective systemic therapies.
So let's talk a little bit about what happened at AUA. And of course, a lot of that is more oriented towards localized disease. But I want to begin with something that you mentioned, which is non-muscle invasive disease, and particularly intravesicular therapy, because I was really impressed by some of the papers presented at AUA, particularly, I don't know if there's another name for the pretzel, I guess TAR 200 or TAR whatever number it's going to be, because I know there are others, but that in particular was, I was, as a medical oncologist, I'm looking at those numbers going, wow, that is impressive. I know maybe it's indirectly compared to other things, but from your point of view as a medical oncologist, obviously you're not the one kind of in the nitty gritty of this, but how do you see the evolution here in non-muscle invasive? Now we're looking at targeted therapy, erdafitinib, et cetera. Not only, how do you think, not just how is that going to affect people clinically, but do you see this potentially actually affecting the longer term natural history of the disease as it's evolving in our patients? And of course, the greatest thing is we could at least avoid cystectomy.
Absolutely. Very exciting data, Neil, overall. And, you know, I would say if you had asked me a few years ago, I'm an optimistic person, I would have never envisioned such a plethora of options emerging in the field of non-muscle invasive disease. And I think that's a direct result of investment happening and many companies going in that field. You know, I think it's a good reminder for all of us that bladder cancer is the fourth most common cancer in men. And if you put both men and women, is the sixth most common cancer in the US. So there is a huge need there. You know, we have about 80,000 new cases of bladder cancer per year, and approximately 16,000 cases of patients who succumb to the disease. So it's a very common disease and a very, I would say, a significant need. I think in terms of the present and the future, because of the BCG shortage that we have experienced in the U.S. for many years, I think that probably pushed many companies to look in that space and try to invest more and help the development of more compounds and effective safe agents. In that context, we have seen, as you said, a plethora of options coming up. We have now two FDA-approved options. Very briefly, is the nadofaragene firadenovec that was approved, I think, December 2022. And this is a viral gene vector carrying the interferon gene. It's actually gene therapy, if you think about it. Intravesical delivery once every 3 months. We recently had the FDA approval of the NH03 together plus BCG. They're looking 15 superagonists. And now we have, as you said, very interesting and impressive emerging data. TAR 200 monotherapy, that's a so-called pretzel, which is this device that is instilled in place in the bladder by urologists once every 3 weeks and has a sustained delivery of gemcitabine, which is an active drug in this disease. And so far, the data from SARISE-1 with the TAR 200 monotherapy, again, this pretzel with sustained release of gemcitabine intravesical, based on the early data we have seen so far, 85 patients, the TAR 200 showed a confirmed clinical complete response based on conventional means, you know, cystoscopy, urine cytology imaging, was 83% clinical complete response. And that is even if the patients did not have a retreatment for non-responders. So responders were 83%. And the estimated 1 year duration of response was about 75% with a median follow-up in responders of about 30 weeks. So the data with that pretzel look very promising. It's not ready for prime time, but I think the SunRISe-1 data that just quoted, it's definitely promising, something to keep an eye on, because that option may be something available in the patients in the future. And just to give another example, Neil, of the emerging data from AUA, in addition to the TAR-200 that I just talked about with the pretzel, SunRISe-1, we also saw data with a different compound, which is an oncolytic immunotherapy. It's a long name. It's called Cretostimogen, and that compound is an interesting one. It's also, as I mentioned, oncolytic immunotherapy. It tries to use a coxsackievirus receptor targeting that happens in many bladder cancer and cells, and that oncolytic immunotherapy approach is trying to elicit an anti-tumor immune response by causing, in theory, immunogenic cell death by targeting and destroying cancer cells and stimulate anti-cancer responses that may trigger a cascade of, you know, cytokines and other inflammatory reactions in the bladder wall. The study that evaluated that Cretostimogen agent was called BOND-003. This is a study with 105 patients with BCG-unresponsive, if I remember, CIS. That study showed a complete response rate of about 75% based on central review. Again, this is a very impressive, I would say, clinical response rate. Again, we saw a similar number with R200, 83% in the same kind of range. And about half of the patients who had a repeat induction converted to a complete response. And there was a 97% progression-free survival in 1 year. So overall, this data with Cretostimogen are not, again, practice changing, but definitely raises the enthusiasm very high, because in the future, if that data, you know, continue to look good with longer follow-up and the durability of response is there, that may be another option down the road. So it's very exciting to see that happening in the field. And that's why I think many patients may potentially think about having more options in that domain. They may potentially push down the cystectomy, and that's the hard part. How many lines do you give before cystectomy? How much do you strongly recommend cystectomy to a patient, which is still a standard for many of those patients? And that's an ongoing continuous dialogue that has to do with the data, efficacy, safety, patient preference, convenience, and priorities.
How much of an issue is quality control of management, particularly of the early stage patients, localized patients in the community? Everything from adequate TURs do they actually follow the, you know, recommended, you know, approaches to BCG? I hear a lot of complexities in the management of non-muscle invasive disease, and I just wonder, with the urologists out there in the community taking care of everything, how much of an issue is that going to be in terms of quality control? And how much of an issue, from your point of view, is cystectomy itself in terms of the community-based quality control?
It's a great question, Neil. And like everything we do, quality matters and experience matters, I would argue. I think talking to colleagues in urology, both in academic settings and in the community, it becomes apparent that quality control in every aspect of the care is very important. For example, let's start with the simple thing, cystoscopies, right? And having an advocate, you know, look in the bladder is very important. In some cases, when is a necessity, even looking in the upper tracts, is important case by case by doing some retrograde pyelograms and, of course, CT urograms. But I think with the technology tools that urologists have these days, for example, blue light or other technology tools, I think the quality of cystoscopy is getting better and better, more sensitive. And there is, of course, variability in the performance characteristics of these technologies. But I think urologists may become better with experience and more volume, of course, and also the technological tools, even with TURBT. And that's another important point. The adequacy of TURBT, transurethral bladder tumor resection, is very important. We had a debate session at the AUA with International Bladder Cancer Group, and we talked about different domains and different hot topics. And one of them, again, was relevant to your question, quality of TURBT. How can we avoid understaging? And that's an important message to the audience out there, that especially T1 disease can be frequently understaged. So it's very important to repeat the TURBT, especially in patients with T1 disease, to make sure you don't miss a T2. And the risk of that understaging is high, is about 20% at least, even with muscular dystropia present. It goes up to 45% at least if you have no muscular dystropia present. So it's very important to have this re-TURBT to avoid missing a T2 that can change the prognosis and change the management of the patient, because you may need neoadjuvant chemotherapy for a vasectomy, or you may need bladder preservation approach for muscle invasive versus non-muscle invasive. The other issue is the quality of follow-up, right? And how much we stick and adhere to the guidelines for surveillance. There are different guidelines, AUA, EAU, etc. And the last point is the adequacy of BCG treatment. Because of the BCG shortage, Neil, there has been variability. People try to, you know, treat as many patients as they can, you know, with a great intent. But if you don't have enough BCG, how do you deal with that? Do you potentially, end up compromising the maintenance in high-risk disease? And so trial showed up to 3 years for high-risk maintenance BCG, up to 1 year for intermediate risk. How do you deal with that? So all those factors may play a role. And I think, adequate training and, of course, experience and volumes play a role. And I think the last point is about radical cystectomy. That's a very complex procedure. Again, I'm not doing it myself, but hearing my colleagues doing it, experience matters. And many community urologists, we work very closely and very well with our friends and colleagues in the community. They refer patients to our urologists at our institution for radical cystectomy, just based on the complexity needs and the nuances around that procedure.
Well, also the supportive team, you know, in terms of the ostomy therapists, nurses, nurse practitioners, et cetera. So one of the things I wanted to do with you is I wanted to infiltrate a little Dr. Grievous Journal Club into our discussion here today. So I just pulled a small sample of papers for you to comment on. So let's start out with some of the papers that I pulled I was curious about and relevant to what we've just been talking about. Nature Review of Urology, Recurrence Mechanisms of Non-Muscle Invasive Bladder Cancer, a Clinical Perspective.
Yes, we published about 2 years ago. And that particular paper looked particularly in patients with non-muscle invasive disease, and we outlined the importance of TURBT, as to your previous question, as a very important diagnostic, and in certain cases, you know, contributor to cure of some of those patients. But we outlined the limitations in TURBTs and some difficulties in ascertaining the complete tumor removal, similar to my previous answer, right? How do we get, the tumor out adequately with TURBT, with adequate muscular dystropia, while we try to avoid, the urologists try to avoid perforating the bladder. And if you look at, hundreds of patients, huge data sets, there is a significant variability of the recurrence rate, anything between 30 to 80%, a huge range, a 5-year recurrence rate. And we in that particular paper, we published 2 years ago, we tried to look at the different mechanism of recurrence, why those recurrence happened. Is it, inadequate tumor removal? Is it just undetectable tumors because of the cancerization field that may happen in urothelium, right? Upper tract, bladder. It's just an undetected, undiagnosed disease that is not just readily diagnosable at the time of the first cancer diagnosis. Is it incomplete resection because of TUR? Is there any potential of tumor reimplantation after a TURBT? Is there a potential risk of drop metastasis from upper tract, you know, down to the bladder? Is there any potential mechanism there of cancer cells kind of, you know, swimming down, right, the urinary tract from upper to lower tract? The reverse, if you have a localized disease, if you put the potential stent, is there a potential risk, small, based on retrospective data, of having seeding of upper tract from a primary bladder tumor? So we try to understand deeper and better these recurrence mechanisms from a clinical perspective, and we try to look at potential implications of the in treatment management, because I think a better understanding of those mechanisms can result in, of course, better quality control, to your point, and better diagnostic approaches, again, technology tools like blue light and others, for optimal diagnosis and, of course, optimal treatment to try to tackle these recurrence mechanisms, either within the urinary tract or, of course, outside the bladder.
So let's talk about muscle invasive disease, and we can talk about neoadjuvant therapy as well as adjuvant treatment. But maybe we can start out with adjuvant treatment. And I'm going to ask you about another paper you were involved with, and urologic oncology. I know a topic you're very interested in, circulating tumor DNA, which, of course, all throughout oncology, there's tremendous interest in. And, you know, I really wonder in the long run, for example, in urothelial bladder cancer, whether somehow this is going to lead to less cystectomies, but we can talk about that more. Maybe you can just review what we know about adjuvant therapy, what you're doing about adjuvant therapy, and maybe a few words about circulating tumor DNA, where you see it coming into urothelial bladder cancer, not just in the localized setting, but of course, all throughout oncology, people using metastatic disease, oligometastatic disease, et cetera.
It's an excellent question, and you're right, Neil, one of my favorite topics. I'll try to put my answer as concise as possible because there's so much to unpack here. So in a nutshell, if we think about therapies first, and then we'll talk about ctDNA. Think about therapies. A single point is, if I have a patient with muscle-invasive bladder cancer, let's focus on bladder cancer for now. Upper tract is also an important topic. But for bladder, if I have a patient who never received neoadjuvant chemotherapy, you know, came to us after cystectomy, and they have a pathologic T3 or T4 stage or node-positive disease, and they're fit for cisplatin, and for whatever reason, refused or not offered, never got it neoadjuvantly, I offer that patient with pathologic T3, T4, or node positive, adjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy, again, for platinum-naive patients, either dose then CEMVAC with growth factor support or GemCis for 4 cycles. I have a slight favor for dose then CEMVAC for neoadjuvant or adjuvant therapy in this setting, based on retrospective and some prospective data in the neoadjuvant setting. But that's the approach for these chemotherapy-naive patients who never got neoadjuvant, but they have high risk of recurrence. If someone already got neoadjuvant chemotherapy and they received, there is no good evidence to give it again adjuvantly. So that's one category. If someone is cisplatin ineligible, unfit based on the GALCI criteria or a variation from the GALCI criteria, or patient refuses platinum whatsoever despite adequate counseling, what do you do? And there we have three important adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor trials. In a nutshell, adjuvant atezo versus observation in Vigor 010, negative trial, no benefit with adjuvant atezo in that setting. We can talk about why maybe in another question. Second trial, adjuvant nivolumab versus placebo. That was a positive trial, disease-free survival benefit. And more recently at EAU in Paris, about a month ago, interim analysis, not final, we saw overall survival benefit, at least for now, with adjuvant nivo versus placebo, strengthening the position of adjuvant nivo in the CheckMate 274 trial. The third trial, the tiebreaker, I call it, is the important ambassador trial, presented by Dr. Apollo at ASCO GU 2024. We're going to have updates in the future. I was part of the ambassador trial, and many patients accrued at our institution. This was adjuvant pembro versus observation, active surveillance, significant disease-free survival benefit, I would say a doubling of median DFS from approximately 14 months with observation about 28 months or so with adjuvant pembro. This was regardless of PD-L1 expression, and in the interim analysis, not final yet, there was no overall survival difference. Overall, practically speaking, if someone meets the criteria for those adjuvant Nivo or Nivo or pembro trials, if they had neoadjuvant chemo but had muscle-invasive residual disease, why PD-L1 or higher, or if they never had neoadjuvant chemo, if they had T3 or higher, T4 or not positive, and they cannot get cisplatin, they're refusing despite adequate counseling, or they're unfit, I offer them adjuvant nivolumab based on the FDA approval. And I think that's a good discussion with the patient about pros and cons, risk of immune-related adverse events, benefits or risk, but I do discuss, and I discuss it, and I offer it to the patient as an option. The second part of the question was, are you going to see the DNA? Long discussion. I will start by saying it's probably the most promising biomarker in urothelial carcinoma these days, especially the minimal residual disease MRD question. It's always about how much data you need to be convinced to adopt in clinical practice and how much, open you are to adopt it. Personally, I see it extremely extremely promising, but I'm waiting for more data to adopt it in clinical practice. Why do I say that? We have seen time and again in multiple trials, data from Derma, Christensen et al., 2019, the paper we published at Nature with Tom Powles and others from Invigor 010, and also data from other neoadjuvant immunotherapy trials, the ctDNA seems to be prognostic. If you have detectable ctDNA, much higher chance of recurrence, shorter disease-free survival, shorter overall survival. ctDNA negative, people do better, have less chance of recurrence, longer DFS OS. So prognostic value, I think, seems to be validated. The big question is the predictive value. We have hypothesis generating data from Invigor 010 we published in Nature. We saw that patients with detectable ctDNA may have better outcomes with atezo. That hypothesis is being tested in the ongoing Invigor 011 trial, adjuvant atezo versus placebo in ctDNA positive patients only. ctDNA negative are not part of it. And then we have another trial in Denmark called Tombola, looking in a similar, in similarly different design. ctDNA positive, they get atezo, ctDNA negative get observed. And the third trial is called Modern by Dr. Galski, an Alliance trial. Very interesting design. ctDNA positive patients, they get Nivo plus another checkpoint inhibitor doublet versus Nivo alone. ctDNA negative, Nivo versus no checkpoint inhibitor. So that trials, these three trials are going to evaluate the clinical utility of ctDNA in the adjuvant setting. If someone has the test and comes to me already with a test, I will look at it. I will discuss, I will put it in the context of a discussion with the patient. I'm just waiting for a little bit more data from the ongoing trials to evaluate the clinical utility and whether there's a predictive value on ctDNA in the adjuvant setting.
It's weird. I get these flashbacks, and I was just thinking about when the Oncotype came out. It's about 20 years ago. And, you know, initially there's, of course, any new technology like that, there was a lot of pushback. So we would do this thing in meetings all the time where we would poll medical oncologists or surgeons, and we would go, okay, would you order an Oncotype in this situation? They go, no, because they don't have the data, et cetera, et cetera. And then we go, well, the surgeon ordered an Oncotype and is low. Would you change your treatment? And they go, yeah. So it really kind of gets into something I want to ask you about. And actually, I was just thinking we're doing a webinar on lung cancer, and I'm going to actually run an idea I had that I'm going to present to them. You tell me if it makes sense. It really gets into a very broad, important issue of when do you have enough data to take action? You know, whether it's one or, you know, whether it's the FDA or you as an individual doctor trying to do the best for your patient. And there's always the, you know, back and forth between how much data, you know, tonight now we have two adjuvant targeted trials in non-small cell lung cancer that EGFR and ALK that are positive. Do we need to do in all these phase three trials, or can we just start applying the model? And I was thinking about something I was going to bring up, and I was curious what your thoughts were about it, which is something I was going to talk to you about later, which is the recent pan-tumor approval of T-DXd, the anti-HER2 ADC. And, you know, prior to that, for example, in lung cancer, they were already using it in mutated disease, but they didn't think they had enough data for amplified disease. And colon cancer, a great waterfall plot, but they're waiting for the phase 3 trial. And then the FDA comes along and says, boom, it's approved, and they're doing it. Not worried about those. And, it really gets, and so think about it, like a pan-tumor approval is saying, yeah, you don't need to do a trial in, very rare adenocarcinoma. If you have an IHC of 3+, it's worth it from a clinical point of view. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about where we are today and sort of applying research to practice. I think one thing that really colors things a lot is funds, money. These are a lot. Most of the new agents are pretty expensive. So just kind of curious more before we kind of get into the nitty gritty about your global thought about, again, when can you apply data to practice?
It's a great question, Neil. And, it's always an answer that is not that easy. And it varies depending on the context of the disease, on the setting, what other options you have available, what is the available data you have, in the existing context, and how thirsty or eager you are. Obviously, to your point, when you have an orphan disease, a very rare tumor, you are kind of really, really, really looking and longing for answers. That may be a lower threshold. And I think the FDA has done a great job, providing the avenue of an accelerated approval. And that approach, I think, has worked in the metastatic urothelial carcinoma. If we go, flashback to your point, 8 years ago, you and me would have a very different dialogue about metastatic urothelial carcinoma at the time. The first approval of checkpoint inhibitor came, I think it was May 2016, literally 8 years ago. And this was atezolizumab, remember, in a metastatic platinum refractory setting. And now atezo was withdrawn. And then there was an explosion of option afterwards. So at that time, we were looking, for a long time for something to happen. And the FDA gave that opportunity to adopt checkpoint inhibition. And then we got more data, the story evolved, and now we use checkpoint inhibitors in a different way, I would say, compared to 2016. I think that the other parameter is access to therapy, and as you alluded to, there is significant difference and I would say disparity across global areas of the world in access. Pembrolizumab and Fortumab is a great example. It's FDA approved, is available in the US, but not outside US for now. These things may change in the near future, but that's a classical example of a really, really effective therapy, life prolonging, you'd argue, that is not accessible for the moment in the vast majority of the world. The other aspect is the quality of the data and how much is enough. I don't think there is a golden answer here. It's very different and variable. And it's like a continuous spectrum when you discuss with a patient. There are pros and cons. And the different data points contribute to that discussion. So going back to ctDNA, I was taking a conservative approach and say I'm waiting for these 3 trials to show clinical utility from a purist perspective. But if I have the data in front of me, the patient comes with a test, yes, I will look at it and I will comment on the prognostic value. And if you are on the edge, the patient is 50-50 in his or her decision making, that may potentially influence go one way or the other because it can impact the rate of recurrence. And the Oncotype DX is a great example of what you said, because even if it's prognostic, if you translate it, to if you have similar, in theory, a test with a similar benefit in both categories, if the rate of recurrence is much lower, then the absolute difference may be different, right? If the percentage difference is the same. So it ends up influencing your decision, and I think it's going to be increasing use of ctDNA down the road.
There are a lot of women walking around today who avoided chemotherapy over the last 20 years because of that assay and similar assay. It's funny you were mentioning when the checkpoints got improved, and I flash back again, the day that happened, I don't know if you remember, but it was Valentine's Day, and it was the ASCO GU meeting, and we were doing a CME program that night. And at the end of the CME program, I said, today the checkpoint inhibitors were just approved in lung cancer. Your infusion rooms are going to start looking a lot different. And oncology, and not just the oncologist's point of view, the nursing, et cetera, tremendously changed. I think the other thing we learned, too, is the patient attitude. The patient's very proactive, wants every possible thing done. That may be a factor. And the other thing in this thing, and this comes up with TDXD that it's hard to explain to people, even in GU oncology, is what we heard and what we've been seeing over the last, 5 or 6 years in breast with this drug. And we have seen story after story, case. I'm not saying everybody responds. Yeah, there's, we're going to get into that. But that's another thing you got to factor. When you start hearing case after case where people had no other options get a great response, maybe a year or two, you got to factor that. That's, sometimes that doesn't exactly come out in the papers exactly the way you see it in practice.
I agree 100%, Neil, and I was just about to amplify what you said, and I think that these stories are important, and I would say to expand on what you just said, real-world experience is important. We try now with databases. We have a multi-center database that we manage with approximately 2,000 patients getting checkpoint inhibition over the last several years, and we try to get manuscripts out there to the world just to comment on little practical questions about the use of checkpoint inhibitors in clinical practice outside the context of clinical trials. Of course, the level of evidence is not as high as having a prospective trial, but it adds up and complements trial data. And there are many examples of those papers. Maybe you and me can do a journal club in the future and comment on some of those. And we, a similar concept is the UNITE study that my former mentee, Dr. Koskin at UCSF, is leading. And we try to answer similar practical real-world questions with antibody-drug conjugates and fortmavedotin, satituzumab, govitecan, because to your point, it's important to capture that real world and, of course, you know, complement the most important clinical trial data. The last thing I would also add to your great point is that sometimes it's hard to capture the symptomatic or palliative benefit that the patient may get, you know, this kind of Lazarus effect. You know, sometimes we joke, you know, I'm Greek, we call it the OPA effect, when a patient really is doing dramatically better, right? They're like pre-hospice and they get a great clinical response. And that's hard to capture in the clinical trial data set. And these stories, I think, help to get them out there.
When I was at the Oncology Nursing Society meeting, I was recounting a story about your boss there, Tom Lynch. The first time I ever met him was 2004. The reason I just thought of him because they were using the drug gefitinib, and there were these so-called Lazarus responses. They even in the literature it was referred to, nobody understood Lazarus responses. So I said to him, I was doing this interview. I said, "Well, why do you think you're seeing these Lazarus responses?" You can tell him this too. And his face got all red, and he said, "Well, I can't talk about that right now." I'm like, "What?" So it turns out, like 2 days later, he was on Good Morning America because the paper in the New England Journal with the EGFR was about to come out, and it was embargoed, so he couldn't talk to me about it. So I emailed him and said, "Hey, you're going to have to finish this interview in a couple of months."
It's an amazing story, and you know, it's great to see these options for the patients.
And now, you know, it's really amazing where that led. So, and that also leads into the next thing I wanted to ask you about, and also gets into this issue of how much data you need, which is the revolution that has occurred in first-line therapy and metastatic disease with EV Pembro. If you could sort of review that first from the point of view of what we were saying, that urologists is going to see these patients. One of the things we want you to tell us is, what are the things that they might see in a patient on EV Pembro that would cause them to say, "Hey, you got to go call your oncologist today." And then the other question is, how much data do we need to bring it into the neoadjuvant setting?
Great questions. And I think, you know, there's all this discussion we have with our urology colleagues in academia and community. Could they potentially deliver systemic therapy? And that's a big question. I always say, It depends on the details, right? And you know, the urologists are amazing people. They're super smart individuals. And of course, in theory, can deliver therapy. The challenge is the supportive system. You alluded to that before, Neil. You know, giving systemic therapy is not only the infusion room and capacity needs that come with it, but also the whole infrastructure, advanced practice provider, nursing team, coordinator of clinic, pharmacist, drug interactions, and management of adverse events. So I think it's very important to have that in mind. So that's why medical oncologists, they're more, I would say, prepared to do it and trained to do it, but also they have the infrastructure around them to deliver systemic therapy. So from the urologist standpoint, I think, you know, interaction with medical oncologists is very important. I think it will make also the urologist's life easier if they have that resource. In the future, we may potentially see urology practices, maybe hiring an advanced practice provider or two of them, or even a med-onc to deliver systemic therapies if we use them more for early disease stages. I think from the urology standpoint, their role, again, is still very, very important, even in advanced disease. As I mentioned, patients may have needs that we discussed before. I think it's important when there is a local definitive therapy, either radical cystectomy or maximum TURBT before chemoradiation, the urologist should definitely set stage for the medical oncology or a donk appointment, discuss with the patient the worry we have about micrometastatic disease, the rationale about why we may consider adjuvant therapy, or at least pros and cons of adjuvant therapy in the case where it may be indicated. And also, if they do the imaging surveillance and, you know, they're doing a great job with that, if they see, you know, a recurrence, definitely, you know, discuss and refer them to medical oncology. There are sometimes some interesting scenarios where you have a great complete response in this gray zone, maybe N3, M1 cases, a great response. And again, the question of consolidation comes to play. It comes in question. And that's a dialogue, again, between urology and med-onc. And the other thing we didn't talk about is there a role of palliative cystectomy in patients who had a metastatic disease, but they have a meaningful prognosis, especially now with Pembro-EV and other therapies. If they are having significant trouble with quality of life, with frequent urination, urgency, nocturia, pain, bleeding, you know, is there a role for palliative cystectomy in select patients? I would say this is probably a small minority of patients, but something to consider case by case, and those with in expected longevity, but very severe urinary tract symptoms. In terms of the utilization of effective therapies in the perioperative setting, we're waiting eagerly, Neil, the results of ongoing phase 3 trials. There are two different approaches there. Is a gemcitabine cisplatin plus minus checkpoint inhibitor, Niagara, KEYNOTE-866, and the nivolumab, GEMCIS-NIVO versus GEMCIS trial. These three trials are expected to produce results in the future. We'll see whether there's an event-free survival benefit or not. In the context of CheckMate 901, in metastatic frontline, I think people are eagerly waiting for these new adjuvant trials. And then there is a second approach with Pembro-EV, and there are two ongoing phase 3 trials, KEYNOTE-B15, this is platinum-eligible patients, Pembro-EV versus GemCis, and the KEYNOTE-905 in Pembro-EV in cisplatin-ineligible patients. And we have to see what these trials show in the perioperative setting. I would say, you know, everybody's waiting eagerly for those perioperative trials. And maybe if those are positive, we'll see if they are, we may move some of those regimens earlier on, which changes completely what we might do if not good, patient has a recurrence later.
So let's move on and talk about HER2-positive bladder cancer, because this really is an important topic that is, maybe not, interesting. I was working with a urologic oncologist for the AUA meeting. We do some videos to prepare for it. And I said, any questions or any thoughts about HER2-positive urothelial bladder cancer? And the urologist, and he said, I think the interest of urologists in HER2-positive disease is 2 or 3 years away. And I said, I disagree. I think it's right now. And I want to chat with you more, like you're talking to urologists on rounds. So the first thing is, can you describe your vision of kind of what HER2 is and the HER2 axis and how you test for it?
Absolutely. And we'll try to make it as practical. You know, it's one of those stories that keep evolving over time. I can share with you, Neil, back in the day, I was still in Greece, I did my PhD in the HER family in colorectal cancer.
Really?
Different disease.
Really? Wow.
This was around 20 years ago. And I was
really
intrigued by this.
Well, that came true. That came true.
Exactly, right?
You got two approvals already.
Exactly, right? We have cetuximab, panitumumab in colorectal cancer, and the story keeps evolving. When I did my fellowship at the University of Michigan a few years later, I was working in the lab, and again, my focus was the HER family, specifically, HER2, HER3, was working in the lab to see whether there is a potential role for targeting these agents. So it's very encouraging to see that moving along over the years. I would keep it in my mind mind simple. And I would say HER2, you know, is an important receptor in the membrane of the cells. And it's very frequently an important driver for oncogenesis, for cancer development, because that particular receptor may be amplified or overexpressed, and also it can be mutated. And in those scenarios, protein overexpression, gene amplification or mutation, or even partnering with other members of the HER family, you know, HER3, they can form a heterodimer, and this can drive oncogenic signaling in the cell, the cascade, you know, through the PI3K, AKT/mTOR pathway, or you know, other signaling pathways, MAP kinase pathway, for example, in the cells. And this can drive cell proliferation, lack of differentiation, maybe resistance to treatment, you know, and of course, cancer development and growth. And it seems to be in across different tumor types, HER2 is being recognized not only in breast cancer, in gastric cancer as well, but now across tumor types as a major driver. Of course, the driving ability of HER2 is very variable across tumor types. And if you look at the TCGA data, the Cancer Genome Atlas project, that look at genomic characterization across tumor types, there's variable degrees of, you know, how often it's amplified or mutated or overexpressed. So that concept, if you think about it, makes it that some patients may benefit from targeting HER2 itself. So in those, let's say, few selected cases, maybe in bladder cancer, it's a small proportion, maybe between 10 and 20%, or approximately, they may have a gene amplification or mutation, and those cancers may be driven by HER2. Maybe there are some other pathways too. And that brings the notion, can you target that with an antibody or a tyrosine kinase inhibitor? And that's where there have been an effort to look at drugs in the past, like lapatinib, like an HER1, HER2 inhibitor. Or we did a study when I was still a fellow with cetuximab, you know, in the front line, cetuximab, and other, you know, trials with afatinib, you know, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and the list goes on. The bottom line is that most of those trials did not show a meaningful benefit in enough patients with a targeting HER2 based on the driving role with targeted therapies, antibodies or TKIs. There may be some signals with afatinib, data from Peter O'Donnell and his team at the University of Chicago, and maybe some selected anecdotes with trastuzumab, pertuzumab in some anecdotal series, My Pathway trial and others. But overall, we have not seen success enough adequately with targeting HER2 based on target therapies, antibodies or TKIs. The story is different, though, with antibody drug conjugates. It's a different story, and I made this distinction because for targeted therapies, you may need enough level of amplification or mutation or something driving the tumor. On the contrary, the antibody drug conjugates, they take a different approach. Regardless, independent of a driving role or not, if you express HER2 or even if you overexpress HER2, that can be used as a point of entry of a targeted chemotherapy payload, kind of a Trojan horse approach. If you overexpress a target, can you use an antibody to bind to that target and use it as a point of entry to the cancer cell and release a non-specific chemotherapy that otherwise you could not use because it's very toxic to give it by itself in a naked fashion, and that trying to get this targeted chemotherapy, that's how I call ADCs, antibody drug conjugates or targeted chemotherapies, in the target and that inside the cancer cells. And that's the story of the HER2 antibody drug conjugates, which is rapidly evolving, and now we have an FDA-approved options. We have two antibody drug conjugates against HER2 that have been evaluated in bladder cancer, and in bladder cell urothelial cancer. And very briefly, I will focus on the trastuzumab deruxtecan, the TTXD, that drug that has a lot of attention, of course, in breast cancer. And we saw the standing ovation a few years ago with HER2 low expression. And the story is that even if you have even a little bit of expression in the membrane of breast cancer cells, this TTXD may work. That's an antibody drug conjugate targeting HER2, an IgG1 class, and it's linked to a chemotherapy payload, again, a Trojan horse approach to deliver this topoisomerase 1 inhibitor inside the cancer cells. And, you know, if you think about, you know, it's eight molecules of a drug in one molecule of an antibody, that's a drug-antibody ratio that's shown in the slide. And the linker is important to link the antibody with a target payload. The idea is, can you test that across solid tumors, and that led to the design of this pan-tumor trial that looked at the TTXD, that antibody drug conjugate, across solid tumors. And that study was published by Dr. Fundamerik and others recently, and showed that across tumor types, you may get a very meaningful response. And obviously, you have to test for the target to see if the HER2 is expressed. And in that particular study, they saw that if you have an overexpression of HER2, and they have a scoring system, immunohistochemistry, IHC, +1, +2, or +3. If you have +3, there is definitely very high response rates, and particularly in bladder cancer. That particular study, there was a small number of patients, about 41 patients, and about 20 of them, if I remember, had IHC +3, and actually 16 of them, to be 1-6, to be precise. In those 16 patients, the response rate was very high, was about 56%, which is, of course, a very high number. The response rate was numerically lower with IHC +2, but still was meaningful, about 36%. Based on the old data on the trial, the FDA approved trastuzumab deruxtecan, the TTXD, across solid tumors after, you know, standard therapy, as long as they have a HER2 overexpressed, defined by immunohistochemistry +3 score, and that's based on the gastric cancer scoring algorithm. So the practical implication is, when you have a patient with metastatic urothelial carcinoma, right now we do tumor next generation sequencing. We reflexively send this tumor out to do NGS, next generation sequencing, to look for molecular alterations like FGFR3 for possible erdafitinib down the road, second or third line or later. Now we're going to add an immunohistochemistry test, talking to pathologists to do, you know, the right assay with the antibody and the scoring system to look for HER2 +3 to look for whether this patient may or not be eligible for trastuzumab deruxtecan. And approximately is very variable, between 15% and 20% of patients may have HER2 +3 overexpression, and those patients may be candidate for this antibody drug conjugate at some point in the treatment course.
So that was such a great description. I was listening so carefully to you. I was reflecting on the fact that I had an oncologist contact us, and he was just saying he liked our work and all, and he just casually mentioned that he listened to our stuff in his car on the way to work and the way home, but he listened in double time. And I'm like, how can you listen to these people in double time? You know? Like listening to what you just said, I barely could grasp it in normal time. But anyhow, let me just go back through a couple of things, particularly for the urologists who may have been straining to keep up to date here. So a couple things. So first of all, in terms of the types of tests that you can do, as you mentioned, you have IHC, which is what this indication is. So if you send that, but again, that, as you say, that's not in the normal workflow. The oncologist or somebody's going to have to send it off and see if it's IHC 3+. However, most of these people are also getting NGS, as you point out. Now, you do get information, although you don't get protein overexpression, but you can see mutations there. And my question is, would you use TDXD there? I don't know. I don't think the indication is, but it works in lung cancer. And also, I think you can see amplification, which is something relevant, at least in breast cancer, but a lot of these studies don't address it.
It's a great question, Neil. I would say, you know, from practicing standpoint, the urologist, you know, again, we work together all the time. They play a very important role. I think discussing with the patient, again, the risk of recurrence, for example, after radical surgery, you know, based on the pathologic stage, is important. And then, you know, working with the medical oncology, you know, if you have a case with very high risk of recurrence or already recurrent metastatic disease, I think it's important to, as you point out, to send this test out, tumor next generation sequencing to look for genomic alterations, and at the same time, immunohistochemistry for HER2. I think the to your point, for the moment, I'm going to reserve this drug probably for later lines of therapy because we have smaller numbers in the single arm study and not randomized data specifically in urothelial. But I will definitely want to know upfront because it may take some time to get the IHC done. And I will focus the use of the drug particularly based on the IHC plus 3 following the label, because we do not know for sure what is happening with amplifications or mutations in the absence of overexpression. Having said that, many amplified cases, it's very likely that we'll have HER2 overexpression in protein level. And because the mechanism of the drug is protein overexpression based, you need the protein to be expressed for the antibody to target there, I would use immunohistochemistry alone for now, regardless of the genomic workup to consider this drug for my patients.
So here's kind of my message to urologists. You tell me whether you agree or disagree. Urologist is seeing a patient in follow-up. They have metastatic disease. They've kind of run out of options. They're starting to think about hospice. And I think there's a question that that urologist should be saying to that patient, which is, do you know whether or not you've had an IHC test for her too? I mean, it's not that complicated. Either you have or not, you can ask your doctor. And, you know, if you happen to be part of the number, you know, people who might be eligible for this, this could mean a very significant clinical benefit to a patient. And this is new stuff. It's not necessarily going to be known by everybody.
Totally agree, Neil. And this actually, you know, has come up in the last month since the FDA approval of the drug. You know, we see patients who have exhausted other options. And I was talking to a couple of community oncologists the other day. We have, you know, great collaboration with them. And, you know, we had a patient who was sent to me for clinical trials. Of course, we try to offer clinical trials all the time across lines of therapy. And when I was talking to them, I said, yeah, please send me the patient. I will see them right away. But also make sure you ask your pathologist to do HER2 staining, exactly what you said. So it's a good reminder for all of us that now that's an option for our patients across solid tumors. And talking to pathologists is key to make sure they have the assay down, right antibody, right scoring system. And if not, to make sure that it's a sent out lab at least, so it's being done for our patients.
And, you know, I'm not trying to say this is a miracle drug, et cetera, et cetera. We're about to get into the other part of this, which is the toxicity that is not a simple issue at all. This is not a, you know, this is something the breast cancer people struggled with, and now the lung cancer, the GI, now everybody's going to be involved with this. But I think it's kind of interesting because the medical oncologists in the communities, they have a lot of experience with TDXD, but all these other specialties, very little experience. So they know, like, the way the breast cancer people deal with it, et cetera. And of course, what I'm talking about is a tolerability issue. So there are a couple of things I wanted to ask you about that I've been hearing from people for the last few years, again, starting with breast cancer, now all these other things. You know, the idea of the ADC was sort of this Trojan horse delivery of chemotherapy. But I think as we've seen this play out, in fact, it seems like there actually is a significant amount of these toxins that get into the circulation. And so one question I had is, one of the things I'm hearing about, from the breast people is pretty significant acute GI toxicity that requires, you know, pretty aggressive monitoring for nausea and vomiting. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I think as you said very correctly, Neil, you know, there's definitely very, very important to have a very detailed discussion with the patient about side effects. So this is across the board, you know, for every possible aspect of drug and every possible mechanism of action, including antibody drug conjugates, immunotherapy, etc. I think nausea has been something that I have been talking about to patients, and also, you know, colleagues of mine who treat breast cancer more, you know, because, you know, they have much more experience with this drug. I have talked to them and say, what are the things we need to keep an eye on? Obviously, any side effect is important, but nausea and vomiting has been something they have told me about. And I think that's, you know, something we have a dialogue with the patient, you know, having them, having antiemetics, you know, at home available, oral antiemetics at home. And, you know, we use, you know, we try to follow the guidelines for that. The other thing that, you know, sometimes comes up, maybe loose stool or diarrhea in some patients. Of course, everybody is very different. Sometimes we'll always look at blood counts to look for cytopenias. Of course, we educate them about, you know, a neutropenic fever and you know, across such toxic therapies across the board. Fatigue, we ask them about their appetite, their taste. We talk about, you know, skin changes, skin rash, you know, across the board, again, with different agents. But one of the things that it's interesting with DDXD, and again, the breast cancer colleagues have more experience, you know, with is the interstitial pneumonitis, which is interesting that, you know, happens, why it happens. And if I recall the breast cancer data, it's probably between 10 and 15% of patients get that, and maybe asymptomatic grade one, radiologic finding, or maybe symptomatic. And I know the guidelines are very strict in how to deal with that. You sometimes people stop the drug, you know, even early on with asymptomatic disease. So that's something we need to get more experience as we use the drug in the clinic, like we did with enfortumab, trastuzumab, erdafitinib. You know, you get more experience when you use a drug. In the meantime, talk to colleagues, talk to experts who have used the drug more, look at the package insert, the guidelines to get more experience, you know, for all the above things, including the interstitial lung disease.
I was trying to remember, were you at our meeting at GU ASCO on bladder cancer? Because we actually I think you might remember that when we got to the HER2 discussion, we actually showed a video of a breast cancer investigator talking about how she manages the toxicity, because they're the ones who really have had the experience here. And of course, again, the ILD thing is very concerning because there have been deaths and, you know, reported. Although when you look at almost, it seems like almost every chemotherapeutic agent out there and a lot of targeted therapies can cause interstitial pneumonitis. And that's another issue. What happens if they've had a previous history? What happens to that, you know, lung? They're worried about if they have chronic lung disease. But, you know, the algorithm that seems to have evolved in breast cancer, and again, this is for somebody who's asymptomatic. They don't exactly know what to do with somebody who has COPD who starts out symptomatic. But if they start out with normal pulmonary function clinically, what they do a very aggressive screening of the lung. I mean, they try to get CAT scans as often as they can for a long time, you know, as often as they can based on insurance. They see grade one, they stop it. And that's when they want to stop it. If they see any symptoms, grade two or higher, they don't restart it, period. Now, you know, there's clinical judgment involved, and maybe there are instances where they do it. They have all these things that if it's grade one, it has to go away in 28 days and all these things. So I assume everybody's just going to follow those algorithms for now.
I agree. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, you know, following the guidelines, you know, the algorithms, you know, the packets insert, and talking to experts who have experience is so valuable. As you mentioned, you know, the more you use a drug, the more you get a sense of it. But it's very important because, as you know, when you start using the drug in the beginning, you know, if you have a bad experience, you know, that's, of course, not good.
Absolutely.
For the patient, but also may impact your future decision-making because of recall bias, right? We tend to recall the negative things that happen sometimes more than the positive things.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. We've seen that happen time and time again. And, you know, I think while you're right, you know, you can, depending upon the trial and the situation, is you may see some kind of pneumonitis in a higher range, you know, like you said, maybe 10% or so. But now with the newer studies, with these algorithms, almost all, you're not seeing many deaths or even grade twos because they're so aggressive. So hopefully that won't be a problem, and, you know, patients will be able to really benefit by this. So I think dose has been another issue that's been out there. It looks like there's more ILD, but there's maybe more benefit. So, I mean, it's to be continued, but from the, you know, maybe I'm just trying to convince people that they got to, you know, look around here, because this really, you know, sometimes things happen and you're not sure how much it's really going to affect patients, but this has really a possibility of really providing some valuable time to patients.
I agree with you, Neil, and, you know, options are important, and patients want to have options, and, you know, they talk about hope, right? And hope is important to them. So
absolutely,
even knowing that there is a potential option is important. The other quick thing I would mention, Neil, in the context of anti-HER2 ADCs, there is another drug that looks very interesting and promising.
Right.
It's called DV or dicitabvedotin, that's a compound that was developed in China, and it was acquired by a U.S. company here. And the data, either as monotherapy, dicitabvedotin alone or combination with a checkpoint inhibitor, look very promising. This is not FDA approved, but they're ongoing phase 2 and phase 3 trials with dicitabvedotin and then HER2 antibody drug conjugate. And that those trials are very important. They're actively accruing. That drug, the DV, it's an anti-HER2 antibody linker, and it has the payload, which is the vedotin, which is the same with the enfortumab. So it's an MMAE macrotubule inhibitor. So it's interesting to see this drug, where it will be positioned. It's being tested for now in the front line, second line. We have to see how it evolves, and we need to understand more about mechanisms of resistance to antibody drug conjugates, because this can influence drug development and will in the future inform the potential sequence of ADCs. You know, can you use one after the other based on the mechanism of resistance?
So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was so excited about T-DXd, I forgot to bring that up to you. But, you know, we've seen other ADCs with the same payload, you know, now part of first-line therapy, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, polatuzumab vedotin. And then in Hodgkin's lymphoma, until recently, it was part of first-line therapy, which was brentuximab vedotin. So it does have a history. I guess you see peripheral neuropathy there that has to be monitored, but no ILD. The other thing I was going to mention to you, you know, you were talking earlier about like the difference between an ADC and the fact that you just need the target for the bomb to drop on it, so to speak, as opposed to this more, I don't know, metabolic approach using TKIs and you know, for example, antibodies. And I was thinking about the fact you said you did your thing on colon HER2, but currently you have tucatinib, trastuzumab as approved of metastatic HER2-positive colorectal cancer. And that is the other way to hit these HER2 things, which is kind of attack the pathway, I guess.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach, a little bit different, and that would require a driving role of those targets, you know, HER2 in particular. The challenge we have, you know, across tumor types, including urothelial carcinoma, is the mechanism of resistance. And sometimes may not be only the HER2 driving the tumor, maybe some redundancy in the pathway, maybe some other molecular alterations. As an example, Neil, we're going to have a paper coming up soon looking at an FGFR3 inhibitor, and it's a very interesting drug, FGFR inhibitor, I would say, that we looked at cross tumor types in a basket trial. Paper will come up soon, maybe discuss. It's a pan-tumor approach. But the what we try to do in that paper is to look at concurrent alterations that may co-occur, you know, along with an FGFR alteration, try to map out, you know, describe, characterize the genomic landscape in particular tumor types. And I think this kind of studies will help us understand better this molecular profile and potentially identify targets and potentially mechanisms of resistance. So it's a more generic comment that applies to your great question about what is the driving role of a particular gene, and what is the micro context of other alterations that may or not confer resistance. And this is very different from tumor type to tumor type, and it's very different across lines of therapy.
So just to conclude, and along the lines of the Journal Club again, I pulled a few other papers I wanted to ask you about. So speaking of FGFR3, when I saw this, I was like, I told my team, I got to ask him about this. Proof 302, phase 3 adjuvant trial of infigratinib. I love it. Like, how many people are you going to get in that?
That's a great question, Neil, and that's a great story. So I can tell you this has been a really, really great effort led by my friends, Dr. Monty Pala, City of Hope, and Dr. Dan Esmant at USC, and I have been involved in that study from early on. And this is an adjuvant trial, phase 3, looking at this adjuvant infigratinib FGFR inhibitor, trying to see whether it has benefit in terms of disease-free survival and overall survival in patients after a radical surgery for upper tract disease. Mainly our population was upper tract, and we included some patients with bladder cancer there, but it was mainly an upper tract. The reason was we know that FGFR3 activating alterations, mutations, fusions happen more commonly in upper tract, and this was infigratinib versus placebo. We tried very hard, but Unfortunately, the study closed early after we have a few patients enrolled because of the company's decision to discontinue the drug development at the time. So we ended up having a meaningful data set. And what we tried to do, Neil, and I presented this data at ASCO 2023 about a year ago, we tried to do exactly what we were discussing before. Can we characterize the frequency of genomic alterations? You know, if we think about, you know, that study, can we describe how frequent the genomic alterations are in the modern era, which I think is important to have a real snapshot, because those patients had the cystectomy tissue being sequenced. And in with a commonly used commercial vendor. And what we saw was that there has been, of course, in the literature, a variable estimation of the FGFR3 alteration. So what we found was in upper tract disease, nephroureterectomy tissues, about 30%, about a third of those, have an FGFR3 alteration. And in bladder cancer, it seems to be about half. It's about 13% of patients, which is a little bit lower than what we had estimated, had the FGFR3 alteration. So we try to characterize those alterations. More commonly you see mutations, less commonly you see fusions. But again, it illustrates the point that when you design a study like this, it's sometimes hard to estimate exactly the incidence unless you do those studies. And of course, it illustrates the point that we have now some tissue that we can look at concurrent alterations as well. We actually have the manuscript, if not published, it's going to be published very soon. Dr. Pal is the first author and is going to describe the clinical data from that experience in a descriptive fashion, descriptive manner, because it was not fully accrued.
Placebo-controlled?
Placebo-controlled, exactly. And this was a big discussion, infigratinib versus placebo. The reason we use placebo, this is an oral drug. And, you know, we had this discussion and the reason for the placebo, at the time the trial was designed, obviously this was before adjuvant nivolumab data came about. It was, you know, probably 4 or 5 years ago when we designed the study. And there was no standard of care, you know, in those patients who are cisplatin ineligible or refused cisplatin or they got it neoadjuvant. So it was, at that time, an ethical approach because there was no adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor. And also, we wanted to make sure we'd use a dropout rate. And we saw from the CheckMate 274, Nivo versus placebo, that dropout rate seems less when you have a placebo. So that's a broader discussion about placebo, but this was an appropriate selection at that time based on the available data at the time and based on input from patient advocates.
No, the only reason I'm asking about placebo was like, I wonder if it's even worth doing. Do you think you're not going to know who's on the drug?
It's a great question. You know, technically, you know,
I mean, how many of these people cruise through it like they're taking Tylenol? I don't think so, right?
I agree with you, Neil. Practically, you're absolutely right. You know, in theory, you know, you keep the blinding and, you know, placebo, in fact, you don't know. And that's in theory correct. You know, practically, sometimes the toxicity profile of the drug, you know, may give it away. Obviously, we try as much as possible to keep it as blinded as possible. But your point is very well taken.
A couple other papers, and I don't know, this is just curious. Intravesicular BCG and incidence of Alzheimer's disease in patients with bladder cancer.
That's a very interesting one. You know, this is one of those stories that started in a discussion in a conference. And, you know, it evolved to become a paper that one of our mentees here, Dr. Makrakis, he's now doing his residency in New York, helped lead along with my colleague, Dr. Wright, in urology. And what we did in that study, we looked at publicly available database, the SEER database, and it's a surveillance epidemiology and results Medicare database. So it's not our institution, but, you know, broader data from the SEER database in patients with high-risk non-muscle invasive disease, and we looked at the BCG dosage and whether there is any association or not with Alzheimer's diagnosis using the, you know, ICD-9, ICD-10 codes, and we used the Cox regression analysis to look at that. Interestingly, in a database, you know, there was many thousands of patients, and we focused, you know, those who got BCG, about half of our database patients, and 8% actually were diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And what we found was with that Cox regression analysis, is that BCG exposure was significantly associated with lower incidence occurrence of Alzheimer's disease, hazard ratio was 0.73, and this was dose-dependent. We also saw that older age, female sex, and black race, and increasing comorbidity index were associated with a greater risk of developing Alzheimer's. So this was a descriptive study, you know, raises many questions and attention, actually, in many meetings, AUA and others. And the hypothesis that was generated was that intravesical BCG, in addition to doing the work it does in treating and managing non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, may be associated with a lower risk of Alzheimer's, which may be dose-dependent. Of course, is not approved in any way in that diagnosis, but it was an interesting observation. And again, association doesn't mean causation, but it was a very interesting you know, study, just raising hypothesis at least about that association between BCG and potentially lower risk of Alzheimer's.
Any hypotheses about the mechanisms?
It's a great question. You know, I don't think we have a great answer. We try to come up with some, you know, hand-waving answers here and there, but I don't think we have a great answer to that question. It's a very important one. And hopefully more studies in the future will try to validate the results and also look at the potential mechanism if it's real.
You think it could be like, you know, sort of a, I don't know what they call it, but, you know, like, for example, it's just there because it's associated like smoking or genetics.
Yeah,
I mean, if it really is related to the dose, okay, that would kind of counteract that. But I'm not sure about that. Anyhow, I just thought it was interesting, just for people to know about the other
for
one
sure.
Other paper. I was just, yeah, no, I mean, I've never heard of that, but cool. That happens every day. I swear, it's unbelievable. All day long, I'm hearing stuff I never heard before, which is hard to believe because all I do is listen to people all day. But anyhow, one more thing I want to ask you about is internet. Based germline genetic testing for men with prostate. I know it's prostate, but I've just been kind of wondering when telemedicine and the internet and all that's going to get more tied into genetic testing. I was curious what you did there.
Thank you so much, Neil. This is a very important topic, and this was led by my colleague here at our institution, Dr. Heather Chang, who is a world pioneer and expert in prostate cancer genetics. And Heather has always had this interest about germline genetic testing in prostate cancer. And her work has been really, really impactful and practice-changing, I would argue, because helped establish that, you know, pretty much germline testing, in addition to somatic testing, two different things, should be done, you know, in all patients with prostate cancer. Now, their guidelines talk about even high-risk localized disease, let alone, of course, metastatic prostate cancer. So it's very important, the message out there from our friends, colleagues in urology and oncologists and of course, patients and advocates, ask, you know, your provider to pursue either germline testing themselves or send to genetics, counseling for consultation, for information, discussion, counseling and consultation about genetic testing that may impact the patient themselves in terms of treatment options down the road, but also the broader family in terms of cascade testing, cancer prevention across tumor types and across genders in the family. So what we did, and Heather led this, it was an interesting idea. Since, you know, germline testing is, you know, is so important, she led a study called Gentleman Study that was designed to determine the feasibility of an internet-based, patient-driven germline testing approach. It was a prospective cohort, patients with prostate cancer had to sign informed consent via an internet-based platform, internet interfacing platform, and they did complete a survey, a questionnaire for demographics and family history information. So this allowed Heather and colleagues to collect the medical data. And genetic testing was performed using the one of those tests called color genomics that contains 30 genes. It's a 30-gene targeted gene panel and contains cancer predisposition genes. And this test was mailed to the patient for it's a saliva test. And the kit was mailed to patients' residents so they can do the test. And then Heather and team collected the results and they put it together in terms of the data, what the findings was. And also there was a genetic expert that was available to provide the results by phone or through telehealth, telemedicine, telehealth, genetic counseling. And that study was very helpful because it showed us the incidence of germline mutations was about, I would say, 9% of patients had the pathogenic or lightly pathogenic germline mutation across DNA repair genes, you know, BRCA2, BRCA1, SEC2, ATM, NB1, and PALB2, and others. And if you, it's interesting that participants were more likely to complete the testing process if they were non-Hispanic white, married, highly educated, and higher income. So it also had an aspect of how important it is to work together to reduce disparities in genetic testing. And there are other studies by Dr. Agrawal and others looking at the major issue of disparities in genetic testing in prostate cancer. So it raises the opportunity for all of us to work together with community, patient advocacy groups, other mechanisms to try to improve upon the need for equity and reduce disparities in genetic testing. This is very helpful for the patients because of potential PARP inhibitors if they develop metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, but also for the broader families for cancer prevention and screening. And hopefully we'll have a higher implementation in the future with hopefully elimination of disparities.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Grievous, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Lowe for Oncology Today.